This is Legalese, where the law is always on your side. Now introducing your host, a longtime veteran of the courts, Dennis Willinchek.
Hey, we're here every Wednesday from 4 to 5. This is Dennis Willinchek, and I'm here with Jack Willinchek and Caitlin Willinchek. So we got a family affair going on here, and we are pleased this week to present to you a great show, I think, with former senator, now superintendent of public instruction, John Huppenthal, and I hope I pronounce your name perfectly because I know my name gets butchered a lot. Was that about right?
I used to go with Huppenthal, but half my family uses that, so either one works.
Okay, that sounds good to me. And anyway, I'll probably just call you John if it's okay. If
that would work.
Easier. But anyway, John Huppenthal, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, good, because, you know, I learned quick. Is, as I said, superintendent of public instruction and took over from Tom Horn, now attorney general, who's been on the show many times, and has been an Arizona resident for over 55 years, educated in elementary and secondary schools in Tucson, and earned an engineering degree from Northern Arizona and an MBA from Arizona State. And during Superintendent Huppenthal's 29 years in public service, he's established himself as one of Arizona's leading education reformers. And during an 18-year career at the Arizona State Legislature, where I believe he served in the Senate, he successfully authored and passed over 200 bills, with a substantial number of them focused on improving education. And as superintendent of public instruction, John is committed to preparing all Arizona students to be competitive in a global economy as a priority. And I just want to say, and I said this to you off the air, John, we're pleased to have you on the show, but out of all the politicians that I've met over the years, and we've had on the show many, most of the leading politicians in the state, I can say that years ago when you were in the Senate, a client of mine had a personal issue. I called your office, and I was lucky enough to get actually through to you, which I thought was amazing, and you actually went out of your way to help my client and take care of the problem, which so many years ago, I don't even remember what it was, but I do remember you from that. And it's funny how that kind of thing stays when you do a good deed, and I honestly remember that as being very unusual for a politician, so I want to compliment you on that. Didn't get a chance before today to do that, but...
You know, very early in my life, literally in the early years of grade school, I read a selection on Plato, and he said he had a great saying in there, government exists to satisfy the people. And that always has stuck with me as a philosophy. And as a legislator, trying to do legislation that reformed laws that were causing people grief.
Yeah.
And now we do it with our whole department. We measure not customer satisfaction, but the degree of excellence, and we make that excellence just before I came down here. As a matter of fact, I was going over with my deputy the rated excellence department by department as they survey their customers to see how well they're doing with regulation, with service, support, that type of thing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Really, it's great. And tell us, before we get rolling, why it is you wanted to be a superintendent of public instruction, having been a state senator for a long time. What is it in your background, and what is it in maybe your education itself that caused you to actually want to do this?
Well, when I was growing up, nobody in my family had ever gone to college. I literally didn't know anybody who had gone to college, and I grew up on the south side of Tucson. If you put a point where I went to grade school, it would be the highest crime area of Tucson. I had essentially went to 100% Hispanic, low-income Hispanic school. And I had a volunteer public school. So I went to Catholic school, and I had a volunteer public school teacher who came over and volunteered in our school to wrestling. And he somehow figured out that I could be an engineer. I had no clue that I could be an engineer. And he called the dean of engineering and said, I'm sending over a student. Sign him up. And I just feel like I'm passing on.
Well, that's great.
What Jack
so he
Sanderson.
Made a difference in your life.
Oh,
yeah,
huge.
Well, and of course, it's often said, but really, teachers do make a difference in people's lives, a major difference in people's lives. I think in all of our lives,
for the better or the worse.
Yeah,
we know now. The research shows that the great ones dramatically the value they create is off the charts. But there are some in our system that they have a different effect on the outcomes of kids.
Well. That's interesting, really is. And so you're saying somewhere in the back of your head always you wanted to sort of go into education in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think another factor was I have always felt that if you're leading, that a key characteristic of great leaders is they have a profound knowledge. And I have spent literally thousands of hours digging through the research, separating good research from bad research, so that I can know at a deep enough level why doesn't this system perform better. And so I think I'm prepared for this job, literally over two decades, many, many thousands of hours talking to the very best, the best superintendents, the best teachers, the best
principals.
Even
when you were in the Senate.
No, when I was in the Senate constantly.
Yeah, well, let's touch on that, I think. What is it? Now, we got two young people here today. Katie just got out of U of A, and Jack just started practicing law. But what is it today that you think, having said that, that when you came aboard as superintendent, was the first thing that you realized is, boy, we got to fix this?
Well, I think the thing I never fully comprehended as a legislator was the degree to which the Department of Education is literally the nerve center for all of our 1.1 million students, 60,000 teachers, 2,000 schools. They interact through a computer in our department, and that computer is literally like the brainstem of the whole system. I never had any clue as to how much damage that malfunctioning computer was doing to everybody's lives. And we figure there are, and you know, I have about 125 people who work for the state to run the whole system, 125 people. But then there's another 350 plus people who work for the federal government. We figure of those 475 people, well over 200 of them are doing nothing but getting data from people, reworking that data, getting it again. Oh, it is so bureaucratic, such an enormous load on the system. We desperately need all that computer programming streamlined, simplified. The computer programs are so bad that there are parallel system after parallel system being operated by paper. It's literally out of the medieval years. And, you know, it's like monks in the monastery tracking all this data. We've got to...
So are you in the process now of doing that or seeking funding for
it? We've done the basics on that. It used to take them 3 weeks to close their books at the end of the year. Now they close them in 8 hours. So we've reduced a tremendous amount of administrative burden there. It used to be when they put in 100 students, 6 weeks later, the system would reject 70 of those students and not tell them why. Now they can, when they get new students, they can put them into the system and immediately get feedback.
It's already working.
We've gotten to the primitive level. But there's
a priority.
There's 100. Oh, if we can just do that, we will allow leadership to focus on the mission, which is supporting teachers, engaging parents, you know, engaging and inspiring students.
Well, you know, I got to ask you before we got to take our break in a couple of minutes, but I got to ask you, you know, I went to school in New York where we have what's called a Regents every year, which was sort of an equalizing thing where everybody had to take this one test regardless of what school you went in, and that kind of gave people a gauge of whether the schools were meeting standards. Do we have anything like that in Arizona or planning on having anything like that, like a standardized test in each course?
We have the Ames exam, which is it doesn't meet that level. And then separate and apart from that...
Because that was on each course you had to take a standardized exam.
And separate from that, the College Board has what they call advanced placement, which fills a very similar role. Mm-hmm. And that is implemented to a variety of degrees in school districts. There are charter schools like the Basis School in which all of their courses are advanced placement. And as a result of that, we have Basis Schools that are ranked at the very top of the nation, literally number one in the nation of all schools.
But you know, are we even thinking along these lines of sort of a standardized Regents type, similar to New York?
The whole we're part of a consortium, and we're moving to what they call the PARC exam, Partnership for Assessing College and Career Readiness.
Okay.
And that would even be a higher level than the Regents exam.
Okay.
And the standard on that, we figure we have about 8% of our students that will be able to pass that test in math.
All right. Well, we're talking to Superintendent of Public Instruction, John Hubenthal, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Dennis Wolinchek here with Katie and Jack Wolinchek after these messages. This is Dennis Wolinchek, and we've got Caitlin and John Wolinchek here, and John Hubenthal, who is Superintendent of Public Instruction for our state. And you know, this is a post, as we were just chatting, that really a lot of people just don't understand, John, what the superintendent does exactly and how your office works. If you can just kind of give our audience, the listening audience, sort of an overview of how that operates.
Well, I'm the director of an agency which implements both federal and state regulations, state laws,
okay,
and also state regulations. I carry out the policies enacted by the State Board of Education, which is an 11-member board that's appointed by the governor, and the governor then appoints specific slots, for example, a school teacher, a community college mm-hmm. president, a university president. So it's those regulations, the federal laws, and the state laws that we enact. So, for example, as a state senator, I put into place a law that says we're going to letter grade every school district in the state.
Okay.
So prior to that, we had labeled every school in the state. So now we're labeling school districts and we're letter grading schools. So we think that letter grading school districts is an important reform. That's where you elect school board members. That's where they hire a superintendent. So now all of a sudden you can't hide behind your two best schools or your one best school. Now your whole district is being graded, and you stand when you go out for electing your school board, there's an accountability.
I see. You go ahead, Caitlin.
If I may, during the break we were talking about how I just graduated from University of Arizona, and a lot of my friends are going into teaching, and you were talking about the changes that are going on in teaching. Could you talk more about that?
I think the modern era has enabled us to do an enormous amount of computer tracking of students, and then to find out what were the experiences of those students, who taught them, what schools did they go to. So the same way that we're letter grading school districts, we hope to soon be letter grading colleges of education. So we know the academic gains of the students of all the teachers that went to the University of Arizona College of Education. And ASU, University of Phoenix, Grand Canyon, NAU, when they did this in Louisiana, immediately it had effects back at the colleges of education. They started reorganizing, focusing on, okay, how do we improve outcomes? What does the research say? So it has a galvanizing effect. Well, one of the indicators in that research is that teachers with content knowledge have students with higher academic gains. So if you had an undergraduate degree in math, you would predict that your students would have higher mathematics gains than a teacher who came in with a general education background.
Hmm. That's fascinating. One of the things I was curious about that I wanted to ask you today is about the federal Department of Education. I know this was something that I heard that people were saying that the Republicans, Romney, wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. How do you interact with the federal Department of Education, and what effect? You said you enforce the federal regulations.
Yeah.
But is there a Department of Education federally that interferes or comes into the state and does something, or do you not deal with them?
Well, we deal with them. Matter of fact, we just finished an extensive negotiation with them on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. They have a variety of programs called the title programs. My observation and looking at the research is that those programs, they spend an enormous amount of money and they have negative effects on academic outcomes. That's pretty brutal to spend that much money. They're about 10-20% of the resources, depending on which year and what degree of, it's been fluctuating lately. But they're about 67% of the bureaucracy. So about two-thirds of my people are federal people. So when Romney said that he would just take all that money and put it on the back of every child and the school that gets that child gets that money, I thought that was a fabulous reform and would really simplify a lot of the bureaucracy. These programs tend to have negative effects because they flow through. They create bureaucrats at the local level. They create bureaucrats in my office. It's a burden that the system has to carry. Instead of it being something that lifts up and provides resources and energizes it, it really is a deadweight loss.
Oh, that's interesting. So actually you were in agreement with his proposal.
Yeah, I think he wasn't really getting rid of the resources. He was getting rid of the bureaucracy and getting the resources into the system in a way it can make a difference.
What would you think right now is the most critical need at the Department of Education?
I had mentioned the computer system, and I would say that, but I would make it a little more vivid. We partnered with the Vail School District that might be perhaps the best school district in the state, or at least it's among the very best in terms of academic gains, in terms of their engagement of parents. So we searched down what might be their best school, and then we went in there and got one of their better teachers. So, and then we said, what is all the information you gather to get ready to teach school? And so it took that teacher 3 to 4 days to gather that information together. And in this day and age, everything that she gathered should be immediately available to all 60,000 teachers instantaneously. And they should be able to spend that 5 days preparing the battle plan for each and every student that they're going to engage in the school system instead of bureaucratic paperwork. So we're talking with 60,000 teachers, 5 days, 300,000 teacher days that should be eliminated as a burden upon, and that demoralizes them too. All that, it just is, it's dead weight loss. So in this day and age, the computer should give them every student's test records all the way back to kindergarten, their attendance records back to kindergarten, and now they have software that should go through and analyze the test data. Because there's a lot.
Now, is this per school district or the entire state?
The entire state.
Yeah.
We should analyze the testing results and give them recommendations for how you can go about lesson plans for this student and have it
yeah,
all
that's
down.
Great. Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, in this computer age that we live in, we can do so much more, right?
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, this we're way overdue.
Federal, do you have the funds to do this, either federal or state funds?
You know, we've got a modest investment the first time around, and we are at least now. I talked about the improvements, mm-hmm. the accounting side of the equation, just getting the accounting system so they know how much money they have.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just now, for the first time in a decade, producing 40-day reports so they have know how much money they have in the bank and what they can count on for to run their district.
So this is a major priority now of your office?
Oh, both systems, the accounting system and the data system for teachers.
So since taking office, 1.5 years ago, this is a major change that you, mm-hmm. you've been making at the department.
Yeah.
Are there any other big changes you've made?
The other one is to change centralized bureaucracies tend to say we're in control and you're not, and actually drain power out of the system. So I talked about the Plato philosophy of government exists to serve. We're doing huge work to institute a culture of service. So we send surveys out to school boards, superintendents, principals, special ed directors, teachers, everybody in the system, and have them rate the quality of what they experience out of our agency. And then we do that by department, and we do it for the overall agency.
This is all new since you've taken office.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we're going to tie that into everybody's pay, and we're not talking about customer satisfaction. We're talking about the degree of excellence.
Right.
And when I started, when you took our excellence numbers and subtracted the percentage you rate as poor or failed, we were underwater. So we, you know, it was just a classic government bureaucracy.
Yeah.
We've climbed about 15 points of excellence, which is about as much as I've seen out of an organization.
Oh, that's fantastic.
History.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while, but I remember ethnic studies was a big thing in Tucson. But mm-hmm. I just read online, though, the achievement has actually gone up since they got rid of the ethnic studies program. So I thought that was kind of a big
shock. Yeah, that was
a
big deal with Tom Horn, wasn't it?
Yeah, because people were against it, but it actually ended up that it was helping people with achievement. So.
Well, the ethnic studies controversy came out about Tucson Unified. It really was raising a lot of issues. And there were a lot of things associated with ethnic studies that were organizationally and not proper. State law requires that school boards approve all of the curriculum that's in place in their school system. None of that ethnic studies had ever been brought up to the school board. We should be proud of everything that we teach in our schools. You should be able to go someplace and say, okay, what are you teaching in this class? You know, week one, week two, week three, what are the books, these kind of things.
Yeah, and we weren't doing that.
It hadn't been up and approved. The principals had no control. Literally, I have something going on in my school. I'm not allowed in that classroom. I'm not in control. So in a whole variety of ways, there were things associated with, we call it ethnic studies, but weren't really ethnic studies at all. There were a lot of problems with what was going on.
Well, you know, we're going to take our news break in just a minute here, but I want to come back and talk about this Proposition 204 issue that failed. And what your take is, John, on where we go from here to ensure adequate funding for education and how that affected that funding and where you're looking to get funding from on that when we come back from the break. So this is Dennis Wilenchek on Legalese with Jack and Caitlin Wilenchek with Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal, and we'll be back after the news. Back on the air, and it's Dennis Wilenchek, Jack Wilenchek, and Caitlin Wilenchek, and Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal with us, who was a former state senator and distinguished state senator, and now heads up the Department of Public Instruction. And we've been talking about a lot of different topics here, but I think one of the topics that I think we have to discuss, maybe we should discuss as the first topic, is the defeat of this proposition on the permanent sales tax, which would go primarily to education. And, you know, John, as I was saying earlier, I think that it's a real confusing, that was a real confusing proposition. And I think you're indicating that you're kind of torn with it yourself for some reasons. Why don't you explain to the public what your perception of that was and how it's going to affect your department?
Well, I think anytime you're talking about a tax increase, there should be a high bar in terms of what you're spending it on. There should be a clear return on investment. The value should be clearly a multiple of what you're spending. And I think 204, the way it was worded, didn't clear that bar. When you think of the things that, in an optimal way, it would have been in there, it would have enhanced school choice. Mm-hmm. But down in the fine print, if you read it closely and you understand how the budgeting process works, it actually represented a threat to charter schools. And the charter, so, I mean, that was a major no-no.
And charter schools have been a big thing for you, right? I mean,
I've worked my heart out to create a school choice environment in Arizona.
Yeah.
So that was very problematic that it represented a threat to charter schools. And it should have done things like finance supplies in the classroom, technology in the classroom, books in the classroom. These are things that the system, there's not enough liquidity in the classroom mm-hmm. to back up the teacher. It should have had technology in the classroom. There is new software out that teachers can use to really is showing that it's so these are the kind of things.
This should have been tied to, like Jack said off the air, it should have been tied to some kind of, like Doug Ducey was saying, some kind
of reform. That was a big argument by guys like Doug Ducey who came out against it. I saw that. I also saw that a lot of people who support charter schools, including the former CEO of Intel, I'm forgetting his name here.
Craig Barrett.
Barrett, who is behind Basis Charter Schools, came out against it, and that was the reason they gave. That wasn't tied into an increase or an improvement in performance of the schools.
Yeah, and then you make it permanent on top of it, which is always a problem. People are afraid of that.
It had some accountability at the state level, but when you considered it over a long horizon, it was only 3% of the total pot that was tied to accountability, and that was at the state level. It really should have went state. There should have been a district component to that accountability, a school component, and a classroom component all the way down the line. And so essentially four barrels, and it should have been a lot more than just 3%.
Did anybody consult with you on this?
We were involved a little bit. Like we provided some wording, but then things broke apart when we just realized that it was drifting away from. And then our sense of it is there was – I love Annie F. Peterson. I mean, she's totally dedicated to schools. I'm a conservative and she's a liberal, but she's got a great heart. But they did what they had to do to get their money, and they went out and in a sense, they sold their soul. There was an awful lot of money going into different things that weren't K-12 education.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, the lion's share, 80, 90, 100% of it should be going in the K-12 system. That's what people want. That's what they support. They want it in the classroom. They want accountability elements. And they want a shorter horizon, 10, 15 years, maybe 20, but they want to know that you'll have an assessment of the whole thing, that it's not permanent. And I think the permanent was particularly, when I saw that it was permanent, I felt like somebody kicked me.
So how do you get your funding now? I mean, what how did that affect you?
Well, I think back to 1993 when I first got in the legislature, things looked pretty bleak and dismal. They look a little bleak and dismal at the national scene right now. 4 months later, we were $750 million better in the budget than we thought. And that was on a school system of, I think, 300,000 and an economy in Arizona of $60 billion. Now we have an economy of $360 billion. If they can get the national economy going, we could be very good very quickly. But we don't, you know, it was totally unexpected.
Why is that? Because we get grants from the federal government, you're saying?
No, Arizona is basically 2X. If the national economy is growing 3, we grow 6.
Oh, I see.
If the national economy is growing 0, yeah, we sort of grow 0.
Right.
And we're sort of close to the 0 point right now.
Do you foresee, as a former state senator, that the legislature could still have the power to impose this sales tax for the same purpose on a temporary basis?
I would think as about as much chance as a snowball in that fabled place.
You mean because it was so overwhelming, they defeated?
Yeah, I think 65-35 plus. I came from there, and I know the culture. I helped create it.
Yes.
It's frugal. Now, they have made a commitment. The governor, in talking about 204, she made a commitment. There is $800 million in cash. Even as bleak as the economy is, it's improved a lot, and there is now cash sitting at the legislature, about $800 million. That sounds like an awful lot, but on a $10 billion budget, and you've got to have some, but there's enough in there to avoid budget cuts if they would make that commitment. I think I think schools have committed and sacrificed enough. There's other entities that need to sacrifice at this point, and schools need to make sure that there are no more budget cuts.
So, I mean, how is this actually going to affect the budget for education in, like, the next year? Is it going to go down? Is it going to stay the same?
They have the funds to keep it constant, our funding constant in education. I wouldn't anticipate an increase at all. There might be a little bit.
So do you have to figure out ways to streamline the system then, or are there going to be cuts in the system?
Oh, tell me about it. I take out my own garbage. I mean,
all right.
We run a very frugal ship. When you're trying to run a system of 2,000 schools.
So you set your priorities.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, what do you have to do based on this? Do you have to readjust those priorities now? And what is the highest priority and what's the lowest, let's say?
Well, I think, you know, in the schools themselves, what they want to do, they're in a competitive environment. They can't have any excuses because they have to produce quality.
Right.
Otherwise, their students walk out the door. Every student that walks out the door, you're looking at $9,000 headed down the street. You're talking about a lower probability of your bond and override elections getting passed. So you have to produce quality despite all this. So you have to focus on your new teacher hires, getting them trained, having a customer focus. So there's no excuses in this environment right now. And as long as you're mission focused, there's enough resources to get the job done. In the old days, you could afford to be pension focused, taking care of all the exiting members, making sure they have fat pensions. Your most senior teachers have the highest pay, so they qualify for the highest. You can't afford that kind of focus now because every student is at risk if you're not putting quality in the classroom.
Now, does the Department of Education, the State Department of Education, have any jurisdiction, if you will, over private schools?
No, we don't. We do have – Arizona, of course, has more school choice than any other state in the nation by far. We have empowerment savings account that our department administers, so we carry out the wishes of the legislature there, and that goes to – parents making a choice for their child, and I always refer to them as members of the public. I'm the superintendent of public instruction, not the superintendent of public schools. So I view them all as the public, and this is a key part of supporting that school choice.
Good. Again, we're facing the break in just about a minute, but
I had a question.
Yeah.
Just because the election is so, you know, it's soon in my mind right now with everyone else, and just to get the trickle-down system, is this all a result of the economy right now, that you're having such difficulties in education? Because I know a lot of voters, when they vote Democrat, they think they're voting for education.
Mm-hmm.
But really, does it just stem from economy? So once we get our economy going, it gets better?
Yeah, I think the resources, particularly in Arizona, we depend on the economy moving along. We're heavily our whole system. And this isn't just at the state level. This is at the federal level. They've seen a collapse in federal revenues of, I think it's in excess of $1 trillion a year as a result of the slower growth of the national economy and the way that the economy, what we lost. We've got to get the economy going if we're going to do the best possible job for our schools.
All right. Well, that's well said. And we're talking with Department of Education Superintendent John Hoopenthal, former senator. This is Dennis Wolinchek, and we're on Legalese, and we'll be back after these commercial messages.
I was gambling in Havana.
Well, I promise you I was not gambling in Havana, but we were in Los Angeles this week, so that was fun. But anyway, this is Dennis Wolinchek, and we're going to be in our last segment of the show here with Superintendent of Public Education, or Public Instruction. I made that mistake. There's a difference, as you said. John Hoopenthal, and former state senator. And, John, Arizona, as I understand, is among 47 states that have adopted new, more rigorous academic standards. Why don't you tell our audience what these standards are and what that means for our schools, school districts, and charter school holders?
Well, when this new standard movement started to move, I was a little bit suspect of it because I've done a lot of reading and research into the standards movement, and I have just come to view it negatively. And it was the standards movement was having a lot of negative effects in education. Essentially, it just started stuffing more and more into a teacher's requirements to cover. And so they were covering 300 days worth of standards in a 180-day school year. And as a result, they were skimming across this knowledge. And they could, quote, cover it, but the kids weren't learning it.
I see.
And so what?
And who adopted this? Was this the legislature or what?
Well, this is the old standards. This new standards, this new approach, the more rigorous stuff, they took and boiled this down to the stuff that the kids were going to need to be career and college ready.
I see.
And so I look at that and I'm going, wow, this is a reform of the standards. This is something that can be very helpful at focusing this system on a college and career ready trajectory. And so that was one thing they did, is to boil it down and focus it. The other thing they did is they.
And who's they? Who are you referring to?
They put together these panels of experts across the states.
Oh.
We were heavily involved in Arizona. Roberta Alley in our department, who's a phenomenal education scientist. And then the next thing they did was focus the standards on nonfiction more. There was way too much fiction in the whole curriculum. Nonfiction is critical for kids from low-income minority backgrounds, critical for all kids, because many of them don't have the background knowledge they need of students that come from higher-income households to be on that college and career-ready trajectory. So the focus on nonfiction. They also talked about interdisciplinary work, that when I do a project, I just don't do a project. I speak about it, I write about it, and I embed mathematics in it. And that what they found is doing that interdisciplinary approach results in much deeper learning. So these standards adopted are flowing out nationwide. They do represent a positive reform. Some of the stuff that comes out that like this, you think, wow, this is a fad. You have to be suspicious of it. I think this passes a deep look and is a powerful positive reform.
So what are some of the challenges associated with raising general overall academic standards, would you say?
Part of it's going to be the shock factor. You know, when you take 100 students that come out of eighth grade, just 18 of those will go on and either get an associate's degree in a community college or a bachelor's degree. And even fewer, just 3 out of 100, will go on to get a bachelor's degree and work in the field in which they got their degree. The system really hasn't confronted that brutal truth yet. And with these new standards, it's going to start confronting that brutal truth right in the early years. So the percentage of students every year that are on a college and career-ready path is going to be a small number. And it's going to be a huge, painful wake-up call for the whole system to every year see the scorecard and see a relatively small number of students that are on that trajectory. That's going to be the feedback loop.
Well, and probably with the job market being what it is, there's probably less and less of them that are going to college, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What can parents do to support the schools and their students in the transition to these new higher standards you just talked about?
Well, I think if you're a parent out there, you should be really focusing your students on developing the habit of reading. And what we find, and it's pretty distressing, is that we have perhaps half of our students that are going home at night and doing no reading at all. Mm. So that we have the standard prescription of 10 minutes a day. I say, forget that. Give me 1 minute, 60 seconds, and then give me that for 60 days in a row. And if you can give me that 1 minute, have your child read out loud for 60 seconds or 45 seconds and develop a little bit of a habit, and then see, okay, we'll go to 2 and 3. We at the fifth grade level, we have thousands and thousands of students that are reading less than a minute a day.
Well, and we were talking off the air, but is it true that nationwide 40% of third graders lack basic reading skills? Is that
absolutely accurate? Third and fourth graders they lack basic reading skills.
That sounds pretty significant to me.
Oh, it's huge, and it sets the pace for the remainder of their educational career.
Sure, of course.
They disconnect.
Now, Arizona has a reputation. We were talking about this off the air, too, with Katie. But Arizona has a reputation of ranking at the bottom of the states in education. Is that true, and are some of these statistics misleading that we hear?
Well, it's misleading in a couple respects. A much higher percentage of our students come from low-income and minority backgrounds. So in order to determine where our schools rank, they have done some really sophisticated studies, spent millions of dollars to compare all the states on an apples-to-apples basis. So this is hard for you to visualize. But our students, on average, when you average fourth and eighth grade reading scores, we rank somewhere around 42nd. But our schools, when you compare them on an apples-to-apples basis, rank about 21st. Then, when you do the calculations, what is it going to take for our schools to get our students in the top 10? Well, they would have to be not only number one, but number one by a chunk. And that's our challenge. But in many respects, so our average schools are down here around 20th, but because we have school choice, if you're an educated consumer, you have available to you the best schools in the nation, unlike any other state. You have the basic schools available to you, the Great Heart schools. These are phenomenal schools, EduPrize, the Phoenix School for the Arts. These schools are sending many, many students to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, the Ivy League schools. They're coming out and producing in large volume.
Yeah.
So in Arizona, unlike other states, if you're a middle-income consumer and you are willing to drive 5, 6, 7 miles, you have within that radius an A school that you can go to, and the doors are open to you.
You know, what about states like Massachusetts are always allegedly ranked number one? We heard Mitt Romney talking about that during the election. Is that a fact or not?
Well, I smiled a little bit when he made that comment, because the RAND Corporation, the nation's premier think tank, did this ranking of the states, and they ranked, as I mentioned, Arizona schools 21st, and they ranked Massachusetts schools 27th.
Hmm.
The Massachusetts, when they end, when they're in the 12th grade, they end up, they're about 8 points ahead of us on the scale that they had. But guess what? On the first day of kindergarten, they were about 10 points ahead of us. So we closed the gap. Not enough.
Why would that be?
Their schools aren't nearly what they would appear to be. All of their
It sounds like they're ahead right from the beginning. You know, could that be?
They're ahead right in the first day of kindergarten, and the advantage they have over other states shrinks over the course of the educational career, doesn't expand.
Could that possibly be because of immigrants going to schools here, or what?
Well, we just have a much higher proportion of our schools that come from low-income minority backgrounds, and they didn't have the advantage, the literature background that many of higher-income families have.
So what's the answer to that? Do we start education earlier?
I think what we have to do is we have to, A, push on for greater school choice. Some schools recruit high-quality teachers. They energize those teachers and grow them every single day that they're in their schools. Other schools, sadly, they don't recruit the best teachers, and then they don't grow them over time.
How does a parent know this? I mean, are the schools ranked in some way that people can check?
Well, I think number one, you go with the letter grading system. You're going to want if that's the only research you do, you want to get your child into an A-rated school.
And but where do they find it out? On the internet?
Yeah, that's on the internet. We post all of those on the front page of our website. You go into, there's a box on the front page, and go down and leaf through the schools. The Charter Schools Association, on their website, they post all the charter schools. You can search by zip code there and determine the charter school site.
So we got a few minutes here. How do we reduce our dropout rates? How do we make high school education relevant so students choose not to drop out?
I think if you look across the systems right now that are doing a great job on this, you got to look at the Peoria School District. Superintendent Santorelli out there and that school board, Hal Bohr, school board president, they've done an amazing job over the last two decades of building a school culture, and they have used a system called My Life, where they give every child a vision for their future, and also career and technical education to drive their graduation rate higher and higher and higher. They're out now up to 94% graduation rate, and it has been a policy thing to behold.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. So it can be done. And we just have a couple of minutes, but how do parents hold teachers and school districts accountable to provide a quality education experience for their children?
Well, I think you start out looking at the academic results. We now letter grade school districts, so you want to know what the letter grade on your local school district is. But it's not just the letter grade. I think you also want to know, do they do a teacher and parent engagement measurement? And potentially a student engagement measurement. So like well-managed school districts like Mesa, they measure teacher job satisfaction and the degree to which teachers feel they're supported in the classroom, and they drive on that number to produce a high-rated excellence by the teachers. The same thing with their parents and the same thing with their students. So you should have a full-bodied set of measurements if you're a well-run school district, so you know the academic gains as well as the people factor.
You know, the hour just goes by. It's unbelievable how quickly it goes.
Dennis, what a pleasure.
Yeah, same here. It really was. And we'll have you on again, hopefully, to get into more detail. But this is Dennis Wilencheck with Caitlin and Jack Wilencheck. And we're at the end of the hour. And we'll talk to our listening audience next week, Wednesday, from 4 to 5 here on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And we've been talking with John Hoopenthal. And we appreciate you having on the show, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right, take care.